Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Well, we go way back. My buddy Dick Gabriel. What's going on, dude? How are you?
I am well, sir. Haven't seen you in forever.
I know. I try to hide a lot. I just try to, you know. No, I'm loving doing the podcasts, and I miss working with you guys. How's your radio show going?
It's going well. We have quite a bit to talk about today.
Yeah.
But even during all of this, the pandemic, it just seems like different issues are coming up. But we're just dying to talk about a real football game.
Yeah, right. Did you watch? Speaking of like real games, did you watch Dr. Anthony Fauci last night with his pitch?
Yeah, he needs a little work.
He's got a wicked curveball, though. Come on. I'm just like
he goes right up there with John Wall and 50 Cent.
Yeah. Just adjusted a little bit. That's all. Well, you can hear Dick Gabriel at Big Blue Insider. You're also on Apple Podcasts as well, not just on 630 WLAP, but also on podcasts. You can download every show, and I highly recommend because you have been – I don't know, man. Whenever I have a question about UK history or whenever I have a question about something having to do with, like, deeper subjects within UK sports, I come to you because you are just this – incredible wealth of years of knowledge of the program.
I'm the old guy.
No, I wasn't trying to say it that way. You still have hair.
No, I've been around. I stayed in one place and turned down a couple opportunities to move. So I looked up and suddenly, you know, I'm the venerable one. But that happens, and I'm not complaining. Lexington's a great place, and I raised my kids here with them, me and their mom. And so, yeah, it's been good.
Where did you have opportunities to move to?
Well, could have moved. I had a shot at a job in Los Angeles, actually, with the horse racing network with TVG. But my kids were just starting in high school,
right?
And you know, my father died when I was young, and I'm like, man, I was without a dad. I don't want them to be with a long distance dad. So I stayed put, and then opportunities began to happen here, and the SEC network cranked up. So there was a chance to do a lot of play-by-play, which you did when you were back here.
Yep.
And you know, that's what radio guys love to do. And I'm doing both some radio and TV, UK baseball and things like that. So it remained a good place to be.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, LA is nice, but you're too nice and humble a guy. Like you know what I mean? It's like you're not the, like, I don't like. You're too good a person. I don't know how else to put that. You're just too good a person.
Well, I have two close friends who work in Los Angeles, one in radio and one in the film industry. He's from Lexington. The guy who worked in radio is from Western Kentucky.
Right.
And, you know, when I told them, they were both, oh, dude, you know.
Yeah.
I would have loved it out here in Atlanta. I said, yeah, I would love seeing you guys, but. It would have been, you talk about culture change.
Yeah. I remember, spending a little bit of time at an audio conference in Los Angeles, and I have some friends there. I have a friend in Malibu and a couple of friends in San Diego, but, they're kind of the exception to the rule. I remember walking around and I thought, this is the biggest city I've ever been in my life, besides maybe New York. Although I think LA might be a little bit bigger. I don't know. They go back and forth. But I remember thinking, I am around more people than I've ever been around in my life, and this is the loneliest feeling place I've ever been.
Yeah.
It's really weird like that. So I wanted to bring you on because of the Rupp Arena controversy, and I want to say this. First of all, this is not a political podcast, but I do think it's important to just make this point. You and I are both on sort of different ends of the political spectrum when it comes to just pure politics. But what's interesting is that I imagine you and I find a lot of common ground on some of the things that have been going on lately. For instance, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I believe and support in police reform. I think I support largely a lot of what the original protests about this have been about. I'm not in favor of celebrating people from the past necessarily. I think we need to acknowledge that they existed, but I don't necessarily think we should vault them that have done horrible things. particularly one side that I think was traitorous and tried to leave our great union. So again, this is not a political podcast, but I just wanted to lay the groundwork to say we come at this slightly differently. But what I wanted was the objective point of view because of what I know and respect about you, in that you dig into things and you allow the facts to take you where the facts lead. And that's kind of what brings us to your column, which was widely shared throughout Kentucky about, and I love the title. I don't know if you wrote the title or not, but it was, "Let Me Interrupt Your Misconceptions About Adolph Rupp with Some Facts on the Race Issue."
Actually, I did not write the headline, but that was a very good headline, and that captured the tone of what I wrote, which was a synopsis of the documentary I produced 15 years ago. So yeah, I was happy with the headline.
Yeah. So let's dive into it, because there is now a debate about whether or not to change the name of Rupp Arena. And I have a feeling, because this is the way discussions like this tend to go, there's going to be a lot of bad information on both sides. And so I think it's important that we dive into really who Rupp was and how, you know, why the name of the arena is named that, and particularly the things that you discovered when you went on this journey. Because my understanding is when you went into this, you know, researching this, you had these conceptions about Adolph Rupp. What were those conceptions?
That he was a jerk.
Right.
I grew up a Kentucky fan and a Louisville fan, but I grew up a UK fan in Louisville, and loved the players and hated the coach, because I was convinced, like so many, that he actively sought to keep his team lily white and tried to exert his influence on the SEC and college basketball in general, that he didn't want black players. And I was completely wrong, you know, and I had just assumed that he was this all-powerful guy who could have done whatever he wanted to do and made whatever changes needed to be made and chose not to. And none of that was the case. And, you know, slowly but surely I came around on it. And it still took a while I was producing the documentary before I was completely convinced. But, you know, I had to keep reminding myself, and people need to understand this now, first and foremost, this is a different time in so many ways that comes up. But we're talking 60 and 70 years ago. Mm-hmm. Coaches today, and it's a bad deal, are the big men on campus.
Right.
You know, I mean, you talk about Kentucky, you don't talk about Eli Capilouto. You talk about John Calipari.
Right.
You know, you talk about maybe not the same right now at U of L because Chris Mack just got there and they got a new football coach. But, you know, at Duke University, who's the president of Duke University?
Don't have any idea. But I know the basketball coach is.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, people now, and in fact, I just watched an interview with a young African-American man who's quite outspoken and is one of the a leader in his community. And he said, you know, Rupp could have essentially made this happen back then. And that was actually not the case back then, just a different time.
Right. And your timeline goes all the way back to 1929. I think your point, too, about different times, because if Coach Calipari wanted to change a policy or do something, I mean, as long as it was within NCAA rules, he could do it. Like you said, he could do whatever he want.
Yep.
1929, you start with that in his timeline, where when he first got hired to coach UK, he was coaching a high school team in Illinois that had a black player on the team.
Yeah, I was amazed to find that out. It was in Illinois, but, you know, it doesn't mean just because it wasn't in the South. I mean, what are you telling me? Racism stops at the Mason-Dixon line?
Right.
No. So, yeah, you know, and it was something that I think a lot of Kentucky fans do know. But a lot of the other stuff they didn't know.
Right. Let's dive into some of that. 1948, you have a timeline. And I love that you did this because it's the timeline is important because you walk through various highlight instances of where Rupp did the opposite of what a lot of people think he was about today, where he actually seemed to be, if you look at the timeline that you have in whole, it almost seems as though Rupp was struggling to move the ball in a certain direction. Now, I don't know what his thinking was. He may have just been thinking that he wanted to broaden his talent pool. You know, he wanted more great players to choose from, and he might not have in his mind been thinking anything one way or the other about race. Or he might have been ahead of his time and been pushing for, at the same time, civil rights. I don't know. Were you able to dive into maybe what his thinking was, what was going on in his mind?
Absolutely. Just from talking to the people who were around him, and I have to stress that, I talked to a lot of people who had never been interviewed, and it's not that I set out to do that, but I kept asking people, why haven't I never heard this before? And they all said the same thing. Nobody ever asked us. I say, no one's ever interviewed you? Nope. Like, wow. So, yeah, back to your point. It wasn't so much that he wanted to be, a civil rights activist. He was a German Mennonite born in the 1800s. He was a guy who wanted to win basketball games.
Right.
And it's hard to think of it in this term, but Kentucky basketball in the 60s, with the exception of the Rupp's Runs team, was essentially irrelevant. It was not the powerhouse that it was in the late 40s and 50s because of the point shaving scandal. Mm-hmm. That really tarnished his program. And Kentucky just was, and UCLA was rolling and all that. And so Rupp saw the Cassie Russells and the Lou Alcindors and the Bill Russells and the JoJo Whites. And he's like, these are great players. I want to win more games. I need to get better players.
Right.
Now, that also coincided with the advent of recruiting because, back in the day, Rupp could just select. He could contact a kid and say, come play for me. Mm-hmm. He could have tryouts, Leland, at Memorial Coliseum. You want to try out? You want a scholarship at Kentucky? Come try out.
Right.
And Rupp would watch these, 18, 20, 25 kids, and then you, you're on the team. That all ended. Mm-hmm. And so now you got to go out and recruit, and you got to recruit African-American players as well. Got to go into their homes, their neighborhoods. And that was also foreign to him, not recruiting blacks, but just recruiting, period. He thought it was ridiculous, as he said, to beg a kid to take a $10,000 scholarship, because that's how important education was to him.
Right.
You got to beg a kid to come to college. And so he was very slow on the uptick there. And my buddy who lives in L.A., his father was Rupp's lawyer.
Huh.
And he told me after the documentary aired, he told me this great story. I'm like, oh, I wish you had told me this before. But he said they had his assistant coach, Harry Lancaster, had a barbecue in the backyard and pulled together all the boosters. And back then, boosters could be the recruiters. And they said, fellas, I brought you here to explain to you that we have to begin recruiting. And they're like, what are you talking about?
Right.
And he had to explain the concept of recruiting to these guys. A lot of these guys, of course, broke rules. But, Rupp never watched Dan Issel play in high school.
Right.
Never watched Pat Riley. Never watched Louis Dampier. Never. You know how many times he watched Wes Unseld play? 13 times.
Huh. Wow.
So times were changing, and I'm 64. He was, 68, 70.
Yeah.
Everything was changing so quickly around him. And that's tough on anybody that age.
Sure. Your whole, that time in our nation's history was a tumultuous time.
Oh.
It was massive upheaval. It was, it was almost like a rebirth in a way. I mean, it was one of those big moments of significant change. Looking back through the timeline, I encourage people to read your article. It's in the Northern Kentucky Tribune. Did the Herald Leader pick it up?
Oh, no.
Okay. Why not?
Remember, this was the newspaper that wrote that I was paid by UK.
Oh, yeah,
to
that's
do
right.
The doc. They fabricated the story.
Yeah, I forgot. Good times. Okay. So I'm going to post the link to this on the Disruption Zone page and also on social media when I post this episode, because I think people need to read it, because it's not like you're sitting here going, Rupp, R-U-P-P, he's the greatest guy
right.
I ever did see. That's not what you're doing. You're trying to give an honest assessment of his life and times and of his contribution to UK. One of the things that sort of stuck out to me was in the early 1960s, Rupp announced publicly that he was going to begin to recruit black players. How big of a deal was that?
Well, that first of all, that shocked me. This is how big it was. He got more than 100 death threats that were turned over to the FBI. He and his assistant coach, Neil Reed, he hired a guy specifically to recruit African-American players. So the two of them got death threats every day, it seemed. But the other thing was, and I had never heard this, Southern media beat him up in print. And, you know, I saw the guy, his son Herky gave me copies of the columns. And the concern with at least one of them was, and I'm sure it was widespread, was, my God, if we had black basketball players, pretty soon we're going to have black football players.
Wow.
You know, and so it was such a bizarre time. And so for him to announce that, and, you know, UK tried to leave the league in the early 60s, or at least Rupp wanted to leave the SEC, because even if he signed black players, the other SEC school says, you can't come to our school and play. You can't go on the road. We won't have black players playing down here. Plus, you know, they're going to have to stay in separate hotels, eat in separate restaurants, and things like that. So Rupp asked for permission to leave. The board of trustees or the athletic board said no, because then nobody will come watch us play non-SEC teams in Memorial Coliseum, which was garbage. Mm-hmm. You know, they would have come and watched Kentucky play anybody. But Dr. James Dickey, who was the president of the SEC, UK president, and he had his two-year term as president of the league, twice put it to the league, let's end this gentleman's agreement and agree to start recruiting black players. And he was overwhelmingly shot down twice.
Wow. That seems courageous what he did. I mean, to announce in the South in 1960-ish, we're going to start recruiting black players. No one else is doing it at the time in the South. The situation, like you said, is everything you said. I mean, people couldn't eat in the same restaurant at that time. And I can't even imagine living in that world. Like, I can't even imagine it. It's just, that's crazy.
Well, you know what else was going on back then was the Klan was killing people and getting away with it.
Right. Right. I mean, there were lynchings. These things were happening, and there are people alive today that lived through that.
You know, and keep in mind that the three civil rights workers who were murdered in Mississippi, two of them were white.
Right.
So, you know, it was non-discriminatory. Yeah. If they didn't like you, they'd kill you.
Right. Rupp was also, at one point, didn't the UK president try to force him to recruit a black player regardless of whether they were talented or not? And that he also pushed back against. Because he didn't want a player that was there just because of their race. He wanted them there because they had talent to play.
Exactly. And that is as much as anything what led people to believe that Rupp was a segregationist, that Rupp didn't want. That's what led me to believe it. That, you know, we kept hearing, oh, he's going through the motions. He's recruiting Butch Beard, Wes Unseld. He's just going through the motions. But Dr. John Oswald, who was the president when the civil rights legislation was passed, he was trying to make sure that the campus was integrated in every corner, which he did a great job. But Rupp balked at signing what Rupp believed would be a token. He said, I'm not going to sign a kid and just sit him on the bench and not play him because everybody will think that that's the only reason I signed him. He said, I'm not going to do that to the kid. So he decided, I need literally a Jackie Robinson type, and he went and met with Branch Rickey to get advice on what kind of kid do we need. And Rickey gave him a list of five characteristics that he used in deciding on signing Jackie Robinson. But Joe Hall disagreed. Joe believed, let's sign a black kid who's a good kid and a good player, not necessarily a superstar. And you know, my words, kind of ease into it. But Rupp believed he needed Jackie Robinson. Plus, he wanted a superstar so he could get right back to winning national titles.
Right. Was there one of the things that must have been complicated for him to deal with at that time in that time frame was the parents of white kids on the team? Was that a tricky?
You know, I never got into that. That's a great question. I never got into that. But I will tell you this, that in talking to guys like Issel and Mike Pratt and Louis Dampier, a lot of these guys, they were already playing against and with black kids. They played, right, you know, with them in high school and on the playground and against them on the playground and in high school. So, you know, this would have been nothing new to them.
Right.
You know, there were black kids playing basketball everywhere. So, you know, they were like, yeah, that's fine. Let's go. Let's just play. We just want to play. We just want to win.
Right. How much do you think, because what's weird is when you watch your documentary, when you read your column, a picture emerges that's quite different than what I know. I had always heard too as well, Dick, that Rupp was racist. I mean, I just always heard that. It was just accepted until I started seeing the stuff that you were putting together, and it changed everything in terms of how I looked at it, because I'm actually thinking the guy was, you know, I don't know that he was a saint in this area, no. but I do think he was courageous. I do think that given the parameters of the context of the time he was living in, he seemed to be principled, meaning, you know, he approached things as this in a consistent manner. You know, the whole thing about not wanting to grab a kid just because of the color of his skin, and wanting to get kids that were on their merit great players. He seemed consistent. It wasn't really about like he was trying to play some public relations game. He was just trying to win games.
Yeah, and in fact, he shied away from a public relations game, from what I'm told. He did not like being in the spotlight for anything other than basketball.
Right.
But at that time, as you know, the 60s, you know, you alluded to the 60s earlier, the most tumultuous decade in our country's modern history, at least. And, you know, now this decade we're in right now, I'm wondering if it's going to be similar.
Right.
But, yeah, you know, now was he a racist? You know, I always talk about whether or not he was a segregationist, because racism, I mean, how do I know what's in a man's heart?
Yeah.
How does anybody know?
Right.
I'm relatively comfortable when it comes to you because of your background.
Right.
You grew up a minority, which right. is another story.
Right.
Which I find fascinating, which you know, I keep bugging you to tell me about it, but it is really interesting. But anyhow, you know, did he use the N-word? Yeah, I'm sure he did. But look, and this is not an excuse,
right?
But far too many people back there were throwing that word back then, were throwing that word around because they were ignorant or insensitive.
Right.
And times are different. It's a different time now, and people like to say he was a man of his time, and that's true. That's not necessarily an excuse, but it's a reason.
Right. Well, and I think that, again, that's the objectivity of this. We don't know what was in his heart, but we do know that some of the things that he did pushed the envelope in a way that ended up bringing us to a better place. And, you know, I heard somebody say the other day when we were talking, there was a big discussion going on about, you know, monuments and tearing statues down. And again, you know, I was actually in support of removing the Jefferson Davis statue from the rotunda. I see no reason whatsoever beyond acknowledging that both presidents of the North and the South were from Kentucky. You know, Jefferson Davis didn't claim Kentucky. We don't want to claim him. He was a traitor. He represented the wrong side. You know, I'm down with that. But in terms of other types of monuments where we look at our other, say, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and so on and so forth, I heard somebody say, and I thought this was really profound, he said, we don't erect statues or name buildings after people because they were perfect. We name buildings and build statues after people because of their accomplishments, meaning
right.
flawed men and women who do things that are beyond the capability typically of a flawed man or woman. And I think that's what you have to look at in terms of context with Rupp, is like in that time period, you know, there was so much rampant racism. There was so much awfulness. To have a guy who, regardless of maybe even how he felt in his heart, was doing things that led to the functional overhaul of a system that ultimately benefited a lot of people, you have to acknowledge that when you look back.
I agree. And, you know, he knew and liked being Adolf Rupp with all caps. He liked being the king. There's no question about that. He wasn't comfortable, I think, you know, if he was portrayed as somebody who was out there trying to make changes and all. He just wanted to win basketball games. Yeah. But what came with that was the attendant attention and pressure. And one of the stories, one of the many, there were two that really stunned me. Well, so many. But when it came to pressure was they had, you know what an intervention group is, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Everybody knows. Well, his quote-unquote friends and boosters, big money people, held an intervention in Rupp's office. He got into the office one morning, the night before he had been watching Wes Unseld again over in Louisville, Planet Seneca. And there were at least a dozen people, I'm told, in his office waiting on him and Neil Reed, his assistant coach. And they set about trying to convince him not to recruit Wes Unseld. Hmm. You don't need him. You don't want him. We don't need black players. He can't read and write. He's not that good of a player. And Rupp was like, that's a lot of BS. His parents are both school teachers. He's an honors student. He's a great player. He only got 8 points last night against a bad team. Yeah, because he was feeding off to his teammates. Every time he'd get a rebound, instead of scoring, he'd hand it off to his teammates so they could score. He had 8 points and like 25 rebounds. So, you know, don't tell me the guy can't play. So I was like, wow. And Leland, I can tell you this, the only reason that the guy I interviewed told me that story was I promised not to name names. The names of people in that room,
wow.
You know who they are.
Wow.
You would recognize the names. And I'm telling you, it would break your heart the way it broke my heart
wow.
to find out who some of those people were.
Wow.
I was stunned. The other thing was the night before the first game with Tom Payne, the first black player, they were playing, I believe, at Northwestern up in Evanston. Or it might have been at Michigan, one of the Michigan schools. Anyhow, they were on the road. And some of Rupp, again, some of his friends, quote unquote, and followers and boosters, came to his hotel room to have, you know, a glass of bourbon with him. And they began to try to convince him not to start him.
Mm.
You know, they tried to convince him, please don't sign him. Please don't play him. Okay, don't start him. And the team trainer was in there and he said they were up till 4 a.m. trying to convince Rupp. And Claude said, when I went to bed, they were still in Rupp's room trying to convince him. I said, what did you think he would do? He said, I thought he would do the right thing and start Tom Payne, which he did.
How stubborn must he have been to stick to whatever it was he was doing for whatever reason he was doing it in that time when everybody was going against him?
Well, that's where the massive ego comes in. That's the one thing. Mind you, I met the man once and just said hello and walked on. I never sat down and talked to him, but from everything I gleaned, he was, to your point, stubborn, but the ego
mm-hmm.
was massive.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that also is what hurt him as well, because there were times that he ran his mouth when he shouldn't have. In fact,
right.
Reggie Warford and I did a documentary on Reggie. He was the first black basketball player ever to graduate from UK. And Reggie said that he popped into Rupp's office one day and they got to talk. And then he said, you know, why didn't you recruit kids that look like me? Well, I had a lot of people paying me not to, you know, which that was, I think, Rupp's ego. You know, he couldn't admit to Reggie that he was a failure
right.
when it came to that. So, yeah, he liked being him.
Right. How much, I want to come back real quick to just kind of a final thought on Rupp in just a minute, but before we wrap it up, you know, sports is kind of funny. I step back now from, as I have stepped back from daily talk radio, your perspective changes a little bit because you start to see the world, you know, when you're in it, when you're in something, how do I explain this? You think about things differently when you're in the heat of things than you do when you're stepping out from the outside of it. And, you know, there's a lot of people are like, with the sports stuff, there's been a lot of, you know, social messages going on in sports. And the gut reaction, I think, for a lot of people is like, just let us watch sports, you know. And there's an element,
yeah.
there's an element to that I appreciate.
Right.
But I also think that if you look at things in context, because I think context is really more important than anything else, and I think we're lacking it in a lot of today's discussions, right or left, doesn't matter. People just tend to do things, say things, think things without context. If you look at sports in context, it's always been a platform for broader discussions that are going on in society. So you look at Rupp, and this is sort of like a, you know, a 20, 30, 40 year span of time where this crazy change was going on in America, and here's this guy that sort of played a role in it, whether he wanted to or meant to or not, stubbornly played a role in it. And so that's like a hugely significant contribution to the country as a whole, based on the platform of sports. What do you think sports' next role is?
Boy, that's a great question. And, you know, it's such a fluid situation now with this COVID mess.
Right.
I think people, we're all reevaluating the role of sports in our society. And like so many things, unfortunately, the political climate has seeped into all of this, and it's bringing out the worst in a lot of people.
Yeah, I agree.
Maybe sports can help bring the best out again in us. You know, a lot of times people can forget about their differences for 2 hours and root for the home team.
Right.
That kind of thing. But I also think that what it's done is made us reevaluate the value and put a face, I think, on athletes and coaches, because so many people have said, you know, do we want to put these kids literally in harm's way by making them play? The pros, that's different. You've got your bubble with the NBA. You've got, you know, the NFL and Major League Baseball in more controlled environments, although those, you know, those are challenging. But college sports, high school sports, you're talking about millions of kids at schools with varying budgets, mm-hmm. and varying opportunities to keep them safe. So I think it's forcing a lot of people to take a good hard look at themselves and at their own society. And for whatever reason, when that happens, I think that's a good thing. I just hope a lot of good comes from it.
Yeah. How much do you think Rupp contributed, again, whether he meant to or not, by being the first in the SEC and being the first, you know, in Kentucky in that sense to sort of desegregate basketball? How much did that contribute to maybe positive changes in the attitudes of Kentuckians? Because you and I know we've covered UK basketball for a long time. If there's one thing that everybody in the Big Blue State will put everything else aside for, it's to watch basketball. And to put people in a situation where maybe they were used to being in a segregated world, where suddenly that was blended on TV, on the radio, in front of them in Memorial Coliseum, did that help push the envelope in the right direction a little bit, even if it wasn't something that was intended?
I wish I could say yes, but I think because Rupp was the last one, for varying reasons, or one of the last ones, I don't know if it had the effect that maybe it could have had.
Right.
Because I've got to think that when Rupp in the early 60s went public with a desire to recruit blacks, I guarantee you there were a lot of Kentucky fans. I just talked about the intervention groups,
right,
who were not happy about
right.
that.
Right.
But, you know, and the other thing too was, you know, because Rupp was such an SOB type, he was not well liked among his coaching peers. So no one was going to bat for this guy.
Right.
You know, no one was standing up for him saying, hey, wait a minute, he's one of the guys who helped put Don Barksdale on the 48 Olympic team, the first African-American Olympian, Olympic basketball player.
Right.
And, you know, so there wasn't a great deal of that because of Rupp. So, and maybe if the facts we had dug up had been more readily and widely disseminated, they might have had a better opinion of him then.
Right.
But, you know, it is coming up now, that's for sure.
It's crazy to think about all the people that were on the wrong side of history. You know what I mean? It's
yep.
like when you look back and you think about all those people in those intervention groups or in the people that stood up against the right thing. I wonder if before they passed away and some are still living, I wonder if any of them ever have said, you know what? I was really wrong. I got that wrong.
Well, you would hope so.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, I had a few people come to me after this documentary first aired back in 2005.
Yeah.
Black and white people telling me just that. And I said, well, I was too.
Right.
You know, and the men and women who are complaining now about Rupp, I was in lockstep with them growing up. And when I first got to Lexington, and I, in 2005, I would have sat back and said, I completely understand this.
Right.
And maybe they're right. But with all due respect now, knowing what I know now, I disagree with them. But I understand where they're coming from. Absolutely.
Right. So with that being said, what's your final analysis? Do you have an opinion on whether it should change or shouldn't change? Or is your goal here more just to make sure that before we do something like that, we understand the context?
I agree with the latter, what you just said. But people need to remember as well that the UK cannot make this change. Rupp Arena belongs to the city.
Right.
But I guarantee you, if there will be a discussion, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And if the city does think about a change, they'll talk, I'm sure, with UK's people. But these are different times, as you all know.
Yeah.
And there are changes being made for the good. I was not aware that there were so many military bases named after Confederate
right.
leaders.
Right.
I have to admit ignorance to that. Never did understand
yeah.
the statues the way, I mean, the context now, I understand now why they were put up in the early 1900s. They weren't put up right after the war.
Right.
And I love the fact that Robert E. Lee requested that they not do it.
Yep. That's something a lot of people don't know, that Robert E. Lee was against monuments precisely because he felt like they were they would be divisive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, to get back to your question, this puts Mitch Barnhart and John Calipari in a tough spot.
Yeah.
Will it be changed? Probably not, but I wouldn't be shocked if it were.
Well, I hope whatever happens, I hope people will have the kind of conversation we're having right now and look at the facts. And because, again, you know, there's some monuments I'm totally cool with them coming down. There's others that I'm like, hold on a second. You know, there's a reason for this history. You know, my wife and I are fascinated with history, Civil War history, American westward expansion history, as you know, where I grew up, Indian Reservation.
Right.
You know, I look at the westward expansion. I try to look at it in its context. You know, there's good and there's a lot of bad and there's a lot of broken promises. And one of the most moving places I've ever been is the place where Battle of the Little Bighorn was.
I've been
Custer
there.
Made his last stand. Yeah. And what's really fascinating to me now, and we went there a couple of years ago, and there was a really great park ranger who gave the full context, and he was like, do you realize what we were doing to the people that were indigenous to this area? You know what
I
mean?
Yes.
And it was like, it
absolutely.
Was, and I love that.
Yeah, I made that trip.
Yeah.
I made that trip, and that, to this day, makes my stomach hurt when I think about that.
Yeah. And it's interesting, when you drive through the park now, they have grave markers and American flags on them for both the soldiers of the Calvary, the Armory, or the Army, and the soldiers for the Native Americans.
Oh, wow.
And I find that fascinating. We actually went through there on 4th of July, the 4th of July day, and they had those American flags on the stones. And I was like, these stones are on both. And I thought that was kind of an interesting, it was just an interesting thing to look at. But anyway, the point is, the context of the history, you know, there's good and there's bad. And it's like, it seems like when our history gets caught up in politics, people are trying to say it's all good or it's all bad. And I'm like, no, the truth is always more complicated than that, right?
Exactly.
And
exactly. I always say facts are confusing.
Yeah, certainly. So I just hope that people will have these discussions, and I hope people will watch your documentary. How can people get a hold of it if they haven't been able to see it? Is it downloadable? Is it streamable? How can they get it?
We hope that at some point we'll have it back up again on Vimeo. It's on YouTube. It's divided into segments. If you want to try to follow it along that way, and I'll let you know if and when we get it up on Vimeo.
Awesome.
And it's available. DVDs are available on Amazon.
Okay, perfect. And the name of the documentary is
Adolph Rupp: Myth, Legend, and Fact.
Yeah. And again, I'm going to post a link to the article that was in the Northern Kentucky Tribune as well. Dick, it's always good talking to you, man. I always enjoy our conversations. We have a lot of fun.
Thanks, man.
All right.
Let's do it again sometime.
All right. You too. Dick Gabriel, he's really a fantastic guy. I have worked with him going all the way back to the beginning of my career, and I want to say this about him. You know, there's a lot of people that I've worked with over the course of my radio career, and some have been nice and some have been not so nice. Dick Gabriel treats every single person he comes into contact with the same amount of respect, and it's awesome. He is a class act, and he's just one of those guys that just – he treats people right. And so really appreciate him a ton, and appreciate him coming on. And I hope that people will have these conversations about the actual context, because there's a lot of knee-jerk reacting right now, and it's frankly getting annoying. So there you go. That's it, man. I just want to have a conversation about the Rupp controversy. You can download the podcast. It's a free podcast download at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and on iHeartRadio's app at iHeart. Go to the iHeartRadio app and then just type in The Disruption Zone. It'll deliver fresh episodes straight to your pocket. So pretty awesome. Thanks to my co-executive producer, Cameron Mills, and co-host, Cameron Mills, and also to JP Web Design, as well as DX Audio Productions in Lexington, Dynamics Audio Productions in Lexington, for their help with the show. Thank you for listening. Appreciate all the downloads. It is crazy how fast this podcast has grown, and we're going to keep shoveling out some more great stuff for you in the near future. So keep listening. Thanks. I'm Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.